Thank you so much. Thanks, Leon, James, everybody. I'm delighted to be back at KITP. I think it's the high temperature is 32 degrees Fahrenheit in Boulder today, so I'm happy to be here. And I'd like to tell you about a new technique we've developed we call ultrafast electron calorimetry. And what it's allowing us to do is develop approaches for some very fine-tuning of materials properties in a way that's different from what's been done before. And I'd like to acknowledge many co-workers, and I'll tell you more about them as I go through the talk. Okay, so for those of you who are not in the ultrafast laser and light source community, there's a huge transformation happening right now, because we're finally getting the same control we have over light in the visible. We're achieving that in the X-ray region, and we can now control the spectrum, the structure, the pulse duration, the polarization of light all the way from the ultraviolet to the X-ray region. And that's possible using the large-scale free electron lasers, but also using tabletop light sources based on extreme nonlinear optics, where we upshift femtosecond lasers to much higher photon energies. And because we can adjust the femtosecond lasers very well, and it's an extreme nonlinear process, we can tailor the light, visible light, and then have that structure or polarization or pulse duration appear in the X-ray region, which gives us a huge amount of degree of control. And we're now learning how to use that control for light-induced materials manipulation. For those of you, again, not in the field, back in the late 80s, early 90s, there was a huge degree of excitement in the chemistry, ultrafast chemistry community, because ultrafast lasers became widely available. And people thought, well, now I have a light source that with pulse duration that's really well matched to electron dynamics, and if I push electrons around, then surely I'll be able to figure out how to make that charge push the nuclei around, and in that case, use light as a catalyst. It doesn't work very well for molecular systems, and the reason is, the minute you push electrons in a different place where they're normally present in a molecule, your potential energy surface completely changes. And so there are some degree of control we can get by breaking one bond versus another, but it's not so universal. What I'm going to try and convince you today is that, in particular with strongly coupled materials such as quasi-2D materials, we can actually use light to drive lattice distortions that you can't get to by doping or strain. And they're just simply not accessible. So what that does is it really opens up the phase diagram of, we have one example to date, but we believe it is going to be transferable to other materials. So it turns out that ultrafast lasers were always doing this, but we didn't have the spectroscopic probes to see what we were doing. And now, because we're just learning how to make the measurements and what they mean, we're actually seeing what we can do. And one of the key aspects was realizing that if we measure the electron temperature, the dynamic electron temperature, that gives us a really powerful probe of phase transitions, because the heat capacity of electrons are much lower than the lattice, and they really are a way to track if your coupling in your material is changing. And instead of thinking about equilibrium behavior of material being very different from the non-equilibrium response, we're finding now that we're able to see what's happening in the material better, that we can actually connect the equilibrium and non-equilibrium behavior of materials. And we've done this for several different materials now, mostly magnetic materials, and now we're beginning to apply the same approach to quasi-2D materials. I probably won't have time to talk about advances in imaging, but perhaps at the poster session or dinner, if you're interested in very advanced electron imaging or EUV imaging to look at, structure for electron imaging or buried interfaces or transport, I'd be happy to talk to you about that. Okay, so I use ultrafast X-rays, and one reason that short wavelength light is very good for looking at materials is that, of course, it penetrates materials that are opaque to visible light, and you can know what element and what its magnetic state or chemical state is by just looking at the characteristic absorption edges, their position or strength or contrast changes depending on oxidation or magnetic state. X-ray probes are non-destructive, and if you have coherence, you can actually take advantage of the short wavelength of the light to make very high spatial resolution imaging, or the high frequency to make very short pulses. And that's possible in a very broad way now, using either high brightness synchrotron sources or the free electron laser sources or the tabletop high harmonic sources that we use. So this is just trying to give you a perspective of how far we've come in sort of trying to understand how we're interacting and probing materials with short bursts of light. If I, talk about, say, the 90s or early 2000s, this is overly broad, and I'm happy to talk details later. But if you think about shining an ultrafast laser on a material, then the electrons absorb the energy. Their heat capacity is much less than that of the ions. They get very hot, up to thousands of Kelvin, and then scattering with phonons will heat up the lattice, and the two baths equilibrate on order of a picosecond or so. And that's the understanding that's been around since, as soon as picosecond lasers were available back since the 1970s. And, it's been used for metals and for magnetic systems, where, again, the spin system was assumed to take time to heat up because you had to have some way to absorb the angular momentum by the lattice. So again, electron phonon coupling was assumed to slow down the transfer of disorder to the spin system. But to some extent, people thought of ultrafast lasers interacting with the material as not very subtle. if you churned everything and put electrons way up in the a conduction band and really induced disorder in the magnetic system, in the spin system, how could you tell what was going on? Now, as we got a little better in understanding, how could we use the pulse duration to tell us something about the material, then we sort of looked, this was work led by Michael Bauer and in collaboration with Kaiserslautern and our group, could we use the fact that the characteristic interactions in some of these, for example, charge density wave materials, you should be able to learn something about the material, taking advantage of the fact that electron hopping was much faster than buildup of screening, and that was much faster than the, let's say, a CDW breathing mode, which would be hundreds of femtoseconds. So hopping could happen in tens of femtoseconds, screening in less than 10 femtoseconds, screening in tens of femtoseconds, but phonon breathing modes would be hundreds of femtoseconds. And certainly we were able to show that we could distinguish between these different materials to identify different class of interactions to identify the dominant interaction. So these are RPs time-resolved RP spectra of these various materials, and just to help with understanding, so the idea was that if we took data at low fluence and high fluence, and if the time, the response time, so this was just a very simple measurement, you know, hit the material with the hammer being your femtosecond laser, and see how fast did it start to change. So here, you know, in this tantalum disulfide, whether we used a low fluence or high fluence, the response time was the same. But in titanium diselenide, if we used low fluence, the response time was 80 femtoseconds, but it decreased if we used high fluence, suggesting that screening was playing a role. But then in these other materials, the response time did not change with fluence, indicating that was a sort of a pars-like material. It turns out, though, that there was way more information present, but we just didn't know how to extract it. Okay, so what did we learn? You know, since 2012, well, we learned that you shouldn't just look at the response time or band structure. That you want to look at the full dynamic band structure, which we can do with RPs. You can look at the gap. You can actually look at the width of the band, which is telling you something about the correlations. We can take a line out across the Fermi level and look at the electron temperature. And then in cases where we can do a correlative spectroscopy, we can actually learn much more about the material. And so, okay, so the technique we're going to use is this thing we've called ultrafast electron calorimetry. So the idea is, you know, you take your RP spectrum and take a line out across the Fermi edge, and this is on a log scale. And so since electron-electron scattering happens on very fast time scales, within about 20 femtoseconds, there is a good temperature established, and then we can fit the line out through the Fermi edge to a well-defined temperature. And then what we do is, if we do this in a charge density wave material or in a magnetic material, now instead of just doing two laser fluences, what we do is we plot the electron temperature as a function of all many, many different laser fluences, and we look for jumps or kinks in the electron temperature, because that tells you if there's a phase transition or if there's a change in coupling. And so we did this, we established the technique using some magnetic materials, because what we found is that as you increase the laser fluence, the electron temperature, instead of following the blue dotted line, it followed that red line. So there was a kink. The kink happened at the Curie temperature, and this was the electron temperature measured 20 femtoseconds after excitation. So what this tells you is all that area in yellow here, that's energy you're pumping into the spin system. It's happening extremely quickly, near instantaneously. And it let us, and we were able to correlate this with magneto-optic data, so it let us establish the technique. And I just don't have time to talk about this, the magnetic materials today. So instead, I'll talk about the quasi-2D charge density wave materials, where we're used to seeing these phase diagrams where one tunes the temperature, and for example, the content of the different constituents to tune the material between, you know, superconducting or charge density wave or metallic. And so we did this for titanium diselenide, and what I want to try and convince you is that we can tune the material with ultrafast laser excitation. Normally in this material, because we're just tuning along, you know, one particular concentration, we expect to be able to move from charge density wave insulator into the normal phase. But what I'll try and convince you is that that with ultrafast laser excitation, we can actually push the material into two different phases. One of them is a metastable charge density wave state that's you know, not as localized as the equilibrium state. This state lives for quite a long time, and in my view, in our field, a nanosecond is a long time. But we can also, you know, normally if you take this material and just heat it, then you would go from the charge density wave state to the normal state. But when we excite with the femtosecond laser, we're going to sort of kick the breathing mode, and it can overshoot. So we can go into this very interesting, we call this an inverse charge density wave state. So we can expand the phase diagram. And so this is metallic, this is charge density wave, and we see very interesting behavior. For example, as we move the material between these different phases, we don't see any bond softening and some other very interesting behaviors. So in this next sequence, I'll just tell you about this new metastable charge density wave state that we see. So the material we're going to look at is the tantalum diselenide, which in the charge density wave state has a Star of David shape that has been seen for quite a long time and with STM and such. We like it because the critical temperature is at 470 Kelvin, so we can do this very nicely. And the thing to note about these materials, which will be important when we excite them with femtosecond laser pulse, is that because they're layered, the in-plane phonons can be excited much more easily than the cross-plane phonons. And in fact, the cross-plane phonons are so weakly coupled that when we excite this material with a laser, we almost turn the material into a 2D material instead of a quasi-2D material, because the coupling is so weak that it takes nanoseconds for these phonons to be excited. How do we excite the breathing mode? Well, of course, because it's a charge density wave material, in the ground state, the electrons are localized on the Star of David, and the unoccupied states are spatially delocalized. So when you come in with the femtosecond laser, you will tend to populate the delocalized states. Then the whole system is in an unstable state, and it'll kick that breathing mode. But the electrons, when you excite the electrons into a spatially delocalized orbital, they will talk to that breathing mode phonon preferentially, not to the weakly coupled phonons. And so you launch that mode, and this has been seen for a long time. So this is a little movie to just show you what we'll be looking at. So what's the signature of the two phases? And this has been seen for a long time, that there's a band shift of about 0.17 eV when the material goes from a CDW to the normal phase. And this is a movie of the time-resolved RP spectra, where you can see that band shift. We'll have to wait for a moment until the movie starts again. So after you excite with the femtosecond laser, you get a shift in the band, and also the gap closes. And so we have two signature of the order parameter that's well known to correlate with that order. So if we excite the material gently, then we are just tweaking that Star of David. So the breathing mode is excited, the band will shift and oscillate, but it'll return back to the CDW phase. If we excite the material very strongly, then we'll melt the order, so the band shifts, the gap closes, and this is exactly the normal phase. What's interesting, what we found, was that there's a state in between that survives over a large parameter space, where we can actually shift the band and change the gap arbitrarily between the two states. It's not a stable state, it's a metastable state. It's metastable for a nanosecond, but it is very interesting. So now let me see if I can prove to you that this is a new metastable CDW state. So we use our technique, ultrafast electron calorimetry, and so what's plotted here is the line out at the Fermi edge, and what's shown here is temperature as a function of fluence. And what you can see is that at a particular fluence, there's suddenly a big jump in temperature, and this is 4 picoseconds after we excited. And wherever we look at the electron temperature, either at the when the electrons are hot, or a little bit afterwards, or when the electron and lattice have equilibrated, wherever we look at that critical fluence, there's a change in slope of the electron temperature versus fluence. And so that's the heat capacity. And if we work out how much the heat capacity would have to change for the slope to change by this much and this temperature to jump, the heat capacity of the material, the whole material, would have to have dropped to a third its normal value. Of course, what is happening is that for this nanosecond or so, we're not exciting the cross-plane phonons. So we've changed that material into a 2D material with a lower heat capacity, which is why we can do this. This is showing, again, a similar graph, except a 3D graph of band shift versus time delay versus fluence. It's just showing this is the normal state, this is the CDW state, and it's just showing that there's a large range of parameter space over which this new CDW state exists. Why do I keep saying it's a new CDW state? Is that we can look at the RPA spectrum all along at multiple places. We start off with in the CDW state with the band gap. Once we excite with the femtosecond laser, we can shift transiently into the normal state where the band shifts and the gap closes, but then it relaxes back into this intermediate state with an intermediate band shift and a band gap. Okay, so that is one way we know it's a CDW state, but there's another way, which is if it's indeed a charge density wave state, then we should be able to re-excite the material for example, sometime later here. And if it really is a CDW material, then we should be able to make the breathing mode ring again. And sure enough, you can do that. That's what's shown here. So this is, again, at different fluences. So if we excite the material somewhat gently and then re-excite, sure enough, we can enhance. This is the band shift, which is related to the CDW order. And essentially, the frequencies are the same. So we know that it is indeed a CDW state. With combinations of pulses and different times, we can arbitrarily put the material anywhere between the CDW state and the normal state. Or if we excite very strongly, we just melt the order. And so for those of you who are not... this just shows the line outs showing what the electron temperature is. For those of you who are used to reading these, so you can see that the laser pulse came in here. This is a very Fermi smeared distribution. Then it begins to cool, and then this is smeared again. So this is where the two pulses come, exciting the material. So the frequency is in this new state, this frequency is the same as the original CDW amplitude mode. So the idea is when we put the material into this new state, there aren't too many oscillations here that we can use to establish the frequency. So the big power of the second pulse is that we can do a better analysis and actually show that it's the same frequency. And then the other very interesting thing that happens in this material is that if we look at low fluence and high fluence, and these are this is the ultrafast electron calorimetry as a function of time showing how this material is behaving. And so the material starts out cold in the charge density wave state, then we heat it and then it cools. You might see here, if you're looking very carefully, that at low fluence it takes a long time to cool, at high fluence it appears to cool faster. So the peak temperature is different, but they're the same color scheme is being used. So that's a little odd. That could only happen if the interactions are changing. And so if we plot the temperature here as a function of time, what we see is that the band is oscillating, which is saying we've excited the breathing mode, but the temperature is also oscillating, the electron temperature. Now this is different from all other observations to date, where it would be unidirectional energy flow from the electron bath to the lattice. And at high fluence, you can see it's quite different. Here, the electron temperature has a slow rise that's in sync with the breathing mode. Here, it rises much faster and then decays much faster. Now, we don't have a full model, so we just made a very simple phenomenological model where we take into account, so what are the electrons, you know, talking to? They're talking to the coherent amplitude mode, they're talking to low energy modes, and they're incoherent coupling, and they're being also being driven by the displacive excitation. So if we do, just again, it's a phenomenological model until we can get a full description, but we take into account that the you know, we've driven the electron temperature, that there's electron phonon coupling, there's anharmonic phonon coupling, and there's also displacive excitation. And with a simple model like that, that allows these, for example, the driving force to change depending on how strongly we excite the material or how much we smear the electrons, we can actually get quite remarkable agreement between the data and this very simple phenomenological simulation. So I think sort of this is good because it just means that if, you know, we've essentially made the material into a more 2D material, more 2D-like material, and there's some chance of being able to, you know, model this theoretically. So take-home story, you can't use a two-temperature model for these strongly coupled materials because there's many interacting parts in the bath. And then finally, in the last few minutes, I'd like to try and persuade you that we can actually make still another new state that we call an inverse CDW state. You would never reach this by just heating up, because if you just heat up the material from this state, you would always get to a normal state. So you can only reach this with an ultrafast laser. So we just whack it very hard, and then you start that breathing mode, and it overshoots, and then you get to that state. So this is relatively new data. So what we do is, how we found this one was not the ultrafast electron calorimetry, but rather looking at the bandwidth. We were just interested to see, as we drove that transition, did the bandwidth change, which might be related to the electron correlation. So at low fluence, you can see the bandwidth and band shift, or coherent mode, are completely well correlated. But at high fluence, when we drive the band shift or drive the atomic displacement beyond that, you know, characteristic of the normal state, the minute the band shift goes above the normal state, we find that the bandwidth decreases. So there's clearly a sort of a you know, this is telling us that there's a change in interaction. So now we plot the bandwidth as a function of shift. So this means this is the CDW state that it started in. This is the normal state that you get to by just going through the phase transition. And these data points here are where we've overdriven the system into an inverse CDW state. And so the interesting thing here is that the bandwidth increases, and then the surprising thing is it decreases. So, which we would not have expected, because that's sort of indicating an increase in correlation. And we have very preliminary theory that from two collaborators at the Chinese Academy of Sciences, where again they're able to calculate the bandwidth and see what we see, that the bandwidth starts small, gets bigger as you approach the normal state. This is just physically, you know, this is a static calculation corresponding to different lattice distortions, and then it decreases if we go to this inverse state. And so I think I am at this point out of time, so I will, let me quickly go to my... your final slides, that I hope I've given you, you know, some small flavor of, you know, the more precise measurements that we're able to make now, that we fully understand, you know, all the data we can take that's telling us more things about the material, allowing us to find new phases that we didn't know were present, and tell us something about the physics present in those phases. And with that, I'd like to thank the amazing student and postdoc team shown here who are responsible for the measurements. They're as fast in the lab as they are on the ski slopes. And I also want to thank collaborators from Keio and NIST, Kaiserslautern and Princeton for samples and collaborations, and in particular our theory collaborators from Uppsala and the Chinese Academy of Sciences, and you for your attention.
Right? So under the pressure, as you show, it becomes a superconductor. I wonder if the superconductivity and the breeding mode are locking.
So we are urgently in need of a better manipulator, so we can cool the sample down, so we can actually explore that regime. Yep.
In its normal state,
yes.
After the pulse, so the electron CW melted, right?
Yes.
But what about the lattice distortion associated with the original CW?
It's gone.
It's also gone.
Yeah, yeah. So that's known from a long time.
Enough for the lattice to react.
The lattice takes about 250 femtoseconds or so to do the quarter cycle of the breeding mode.
Right.
And that, the interesting thing is that I would have thought with the charges, you know, the interatomic potential must be quite unique in this material, because for all of the regions until it collapses, when it transitions to the normal state, the frequency is pretty much the same, which is of this breathing mode.
So fast for this particular distortion.
We don't call that fast though. It's about a 500 femtosecond period.
So the normal, you think is a normal in terms
yes,
of lattice?
Yes, yes, yes. It may have gaps in some regions, so it's not completely metallic, and that is what is interesting about the inverse CDW state. It's actually more metallic than the normal state. It's a strange, you know, distortion that you couldn't actually, you know, make any other way except with the light.
I think it's common that this CDW transition is associated with a fairly large lattice distortion.
Oh, and it is, yes, absolutely.
The phase transition.
Well, that's the question, because this when we look in the time domain, it's exhibiting sort of mixtures of first and second order. Yeah, and so, and
I was just wondering, you know,
yeah. Oh, but it's a very big, that's, it's a huge distortion, because this, that STM tells you what it, shows you what it is. It's huge. This is the STM image.
Yeah, so I'm wondering if you can
it's huge.
Special normal stage with
yeah, so that's the, I'm not sure if that's the same material, but yeah, it's a big lattice distortion. Yeah. Yes, so absolutely. When we drive that transition, the
electron
and the atoms are moved, the spacing then is uniform. So you're losing that Star of David. Now, it's interesting. So this is hard to look at with the nanotip scanning because it's, you still don't have quite enough spatial resolution to do it. And ultrafast electron might be able to see it. Some of the high energy might be able to actually see these positions in real time. That would be very nice to do as a complement. Yeah. So we've talked to some people to see if they might be able to do that. Yeah.
In the case of quantum isotropy,
uh-huh.
That you assume should be lower habitat, right? So you are now measuring the quantum selenite.
Yes. We had hoped that was going to be simpler, so that's why we picked tantalum diselenide first. But I think when we get a better manipulator and we can cool the material, we'll be able to look at tantalum disulfide.
Yeah, but my question is, if you are seeing the tantalum selenite, right?
Yeah.
So your band can be a lower habitat band or just a band?
It's the titanium 5D band.
So can it be a lower habitat band? Or...
Related question. Can you go back
to your sure. Okay. This one? These are very preliminary. We didn't get a chance to talk about them yet, so I may or may not be able to answer your question. Oops. Yeah. Is that it? Okay.
So my question is,
I see. Well,
in the case of dynamical mean-field theory, you may see some Hilbert state. So I wonder if you just see the shift or something more.
Well, the movie I showed was real data.
So
that's real data. Yeah, so we see the shift very nicely. We see the gap. They're completely correlated.
Yeah, I think a related question is that if you look at the calculation, selenium is bigger. So selenium p orbitals are quite mixed, I think.
Okay.
So if you're using what he's suggesting, Surfer, it might be better to... So in other words, what we are saying is that can you differentiate the d orbital from
a few orbitals. So we've done that in other work. You can separate the from the yes, absolutely. Yeah, I see if I have that picture here. Yeah, I may have. Here it is. This is other work where we can see the selenium 4p, the titanium 3d, and so yeah, you can.
You can see the selenium 3 up there.
Sorry, this is very small, but yeah, yeah.
Bring the p orbitals lower,
yeah.
And then trying to see the d orbital physics. I think that's what.
Okay.
Suggests.
Yeah. Yes.
That's not a mass system.
No, it's not. That's right, yeah. Okay. Yep. Yeah. Well, they move, they change in width, Yeah.
Okay, let's thank Michael again.